This second chapter in the unit is about the molecular basis of inheritance, meaning, molecularly speaking, what is the particle that allows for inheritance? Now, we all know the answer nowadays, right? It's DNA. But it wasn't all that long ago that we had no idea that it was DNA. We have known for millennia, for longer than there has been biology, that inheritance happens, right? For thousands of years, we've recognized that offspring have traits that are similar to their parents, and therefore somehow parents are delivering these traits to offspring. But even once we had formal sciences, including biology, there was a pretty long time when, even though we knew there was inheritance, and even though it was reasonable to assume that some sort of particle or chemical is responsible for that, we had no idea what it was. This first slide is the results of an important experiment along the way. It's important because it's the first demonstration of a molecular particle. I mean, a molecular inheritance particle. In other words, it's the first experiment to demonstrate that there is a molecular basis to inheritance. There is a particle that is responsible. What happened is that they used a population of unwilling mice as their subjects, and two different strains of bacteria, same species of bacteria, but two different strains. So they differed in their traits. There's the so-called S strain, or S cells, and the so-called R. S stands for smooth because of the way they look under a scope, and R for rough. But the important thing to know about the difference is that the S cells are the dangerous versions. They're the pathogenic strain, because if you, as you see here, inject living S cells into the mouse, or the mice, because they did it several times, they die. They develop pneumonia from the infection, and they die. R cells, on the other hand, you can give them an injection of living R cells, and they don't die. Okay, so that's the difference between S and R. In this third batch, they used the dangerous S version, but before they injected it, they carefully heated it up so that none of those cells was alive. They were the dangerous version, but they were dead. And not surprisingly, the mice did not die, because dead cells don't cause disease. The really interesting one, though, is the fourth one, in which they started the same way as the third. They used the S version, the dangerous ones, but the heat killed them first. And then they added to those dead S cells living R cells, which are the harmless type. And surprisingly, the mice died, even though the only thing living were the harmless version. And that's why this is an important experiment historically, because it showed that there is some material that is changing the traits of these R cells. In other words, there is a molecular basis of inheritance. Now, this experiment does not at all say what that material is. It just says that there's a material basis for traits and heredity. What this actually was going on here is a demonstration of what we call bacterial transformation. Transformation is the situation in which a bacterium is able to take up naked DNA from the environment. Now, by naked DNA, what I mean is DNA that's no longer in a cell. It used to be in a living cell. The cell has died and ruptured, and it spilled its DNA out into the environment. Under the right conditions, a bacterium can happen along and take this DNA, which could be DNA from some other organism, not even a bacterium, and start using it as though it's its own DNA. And this is how the R cells really transformed into S cells by taking up S DNA. But they had no idea that it was DNA. They just demonstrated that it's some sort of genetic material. As soon as you have that question answered, though, the next big question, of course, is what is this material? So that leads to another important experiment later on. Before I show you what's in the picture of slide 2, let me just tell you about what biologists were thinking after that first experiment. So the first experiment demonstrated that there is a molecule of heredity, basically. Big question is, what is it? Well, biologists knew that any given organism is made of all kinds of molecules, right? Some of them small, some of them big. But it was unlikely that small molecules like water or glucose were responsible for heredity. Even though technically it was possible, they're basically trying to logically make things easier by eliminating the things that aren't very good candidates. So they discounted the small molecules. And they said it's probably one of the four biological macromolecules. Just for chemical reasons, we already knew about the four biological macromolecules. Even though we didn't know what they were all for, we knew that all organisms had polysaccharides, polynucleotides, polypeptides, and lipids. And so they said it's probably one of these, and even more specifically, we can probably eliminate, for various reasons, polysaccharides, which they knew more about than the others and what they were all about, and lipids, because they're the least complex of the four. So it's not to say that it was impossible for them to be. They just said, let's start by narrowing it down preliminarily to polypeptides and nucleic acids, or polynucleotides. Now, the reason that they included polypeptides is because they're so complex, so potentially complex, right? A protein or a polypeptide can be just as complex as you want it to be because they can have just about any shape. So the majority of biologists at this time guessed before the experiments that the genetic material must be protein, polypeptides, not DNA. Simply because they figured anything that's responsible for the complexity of inheritance must itself be a complex molecule. That was their reasoning. So most of them expected it to be proteins. But they kept nucleic acids, DNA, in the mix, mostly because they knew organisms had it and they didn't really know what it was for otherwise. So they said, well, let's test it as well. And therefore, it really boiled down in this first round to deciding, is it DNA or is it protein or maybe neither? All right? And that brings us to this next experiment. What we're looking at here is a bacterial cell. One bacterium, not even the whole thing. This is a really close-up picture. This is just part of the cell. And then three green alien-looking things, which are viri, on its surface. Now, specifically, these are bacteriophages, these green things. And importantly, a bacteriophage is not a bacterium. The brown thing is the bacterium. Bacteriophage is kind of a misnomer because it literally means bacterium eater. Phage, just like in phagocytosis, means eat. Well, a virus does not eat a bacterium. But anyway, a bacteriophage is not a bacterium. A bacteriophage is a virus that can infect a bacterium. And whether it's a bacteriophage or any other kind of virus, no virus is an organism, first of all. Now, why is that true? Well, yeah. But what is it? So it's not living means it doesn't have metabolism. That's true. That's functionally why it's not an organism. Why is it structurally true that it's not an organism? What is the mere structural requirement, the minimum requirement for being an organism? No, bacteria, which are by far most of the organisms on Earth, have no nucleus. The prokaryotes don't have a nucleus. They're certainly organisms. What is it that a bacterium has, though, that a virus doesn't? Which is another way of asking the same question. The bare minimum structural requirement for an organism, what is it? No. A cell. You have to have at least one cell. Remember early on, in the beginning of the term, I said that cells are like little test tubes in which the chemistry that we call life, which is really metabolism, can occur in isolation from the surroundings. To be an organism, you have to have at least one cell. Well, a virus isn't even close to being a cell. It's really just a collection of a couple molecules. And that brings up why these were chosen by the experimenters in this next experiment. Remember that the question they're trying to answer is the genetic material DNA or is it protein? So they chose something, a bacteriophage, that's made out of both of those things and only those two things. Each bacteriophage, each virus, is really just a DNA wrapped by protein. So it's made out of protein and DNA, and that's it. Now, if a bacterium comes in contact with a virus, and I say that because the virus really is doing nothing on its own, it's just a collection of molecules. It doesn't walk around and actively infect anything. But if a bacterium gets exposed to it, it can make a connection, and that's when the infection occurs. And what happens is that part of the virus gets injected into the bacterial cell, part of it's left behind. And the part that gets injected into the bacterial cell is the genetic material, because that's what causes the change to happen in the bacterium. Well, we already know which of the two pieces gets injected in, right? It's DNA. But they didn't know that back then, and that's why they chose this virus, because it has to be one or the other to test this question. Here's what the experimental setup looks like. Slide 3. So they ran two different batches, and they had to keep track separately of the protein part of the virus and the DNA part of the virus. That's why there are two batches. And these are invisibly small molecules, proteins and nucleic acids or DNA molecules. So they had to use something in which they could detect somehow where that DNA was and where the protein was. They used radio labeling. Radio labeling uses radioisotopes, which are radioactive isotopes of elements, because the radioactivity that they emit can be detected by instruments. So that's how they could tell where the protein is and where the DNA is. But they did it in separate batches. In the pink batch, they used radioactive sulfur, a radioactive isotope. Now, it's still sulfur, just like ordinary sulfur, but it's radioactive. And in this batch, which had only radioactive sulfur as its sulfur source, they allowed bacteria to create more and more viruses, because when a cell gets infected, it gets fooled into making more and more virus copies. That's how viri reproduce. They don't reproduce on their own. They require a living organism to do that. But when that's occurring in an environment in which the only source of sulfur is radioactive, that means that radioactive sulfur gets incorporated into the protein. Now, sulfur was a good choice here, because you want to label just the protein, not the DNA, in this batch. DNA doesn't use sulfur in its in its atoms. And proteins do, because some amino acids have sulfur in them. Like I was talking about the disulfide bridges that strengthen proteins in a different earlier chapter. That's why they use sulfur. So that means that the protein part of the viruses in this batch got labeled with radioactivity. In the other batch, they use radioactive phosphorus. Also a good choice, because every single nucleotide of the millions that get strung together to make up a DNA has phosphate, and therefore phosphorus, because a phosphorus is part of the phosphate group. Whereas protein doesn't use phosphorus very much. So that's going to label the DNA, but not the protein in that other batch. Then they just let the bacteria get infected, which means in both batches, something gets injected into the DNA. Now, it's the same thing that's getting injected into the DNA, but they're able to detect them differently based on their radioactivities. Then they put the two batches in separately into just an ordinary bar blender that they happen to have, which ended up being the perfect tool for the job, actually, because when a virus injects its material into the cell, the part that's left behind is an empty shell, basically, and they needed to get that detached from the infected cells so that it would be separate. Okay, so they needed to be a vigorous enough stirring that it would break off these empty shells, but it couldn't be so vigorous a stirring that it would burst the bacterial cells. Because if you burst the cells, it's ruined, right? You need to keep the stuff that's injected, which is what you're trying to figure out, inside the cells so they can't burst. And a bar blender did the perfect job of that. Then each batch was centrifuged. And in any centrifugation, the heaviest stuff falls to the bottom. The lighter stuff floats above it, right? Well, in both of these cases, by far the heaviest thing was the cells themselves, the bacterial cells. They're much heavier than all the liquid and the other stuff, these empty shells. So they did that in both batches, and then they just looked for radioactivity. In the pink batch, they noticed that there was no radioactivity being emitted by the pellet, which is where the cells are. So that tells them that the pink one was the one that was the protein was labeled. So that tells them that it was not the protein that got injected, because the cells didn't have any of that radioactivity from the protein. But in the other one, the pellet was rich in radioactivity, telling them that it was DNA that was injected. And therefore, DNA and not protein is the molecule of inheritance. Now, as well-designed and convincing an experiment as this it was, it actually didn't convince all the biologists. So biologists before the experiment were saying, I would be very surprised if it wasn't protein. Then these results came in, and some of them said, well, what this shows you is that DNA might be the genetic material for a bacterium, but for something very complex like a human, I think it's still going to be protein. Well, they obviously were wrong about that. They eventually learned that they were wrong, and it's universally DNA, not protein, that is the genetic material. Okay, 4 gives us a little view of one strand of DNA for us to review some things. We've learned this before, but first of all, DNA is normally a double-stranded particle. We're looking at just one strand here, just for simplicity, but it's kind of a word game. When we say one DNA, keep in mind that's actually two molecules, technically. Because one DNA means both strands, and each strand in its own right is a complete molecule. It's a polynucleotide. A strand is a polynucleotide because it's a polymer made by stringing together a bunch of monomers. Just like polysaccharides and polypeptides are polymers, right? Polysaccharides are polymers made by stringing together monosaccharides. Polypeptides are polymers made by stringing together amino acids. Polynucleotides are polymers made by stringing together nucleotides. So a nucleotide, you see four of them here, out of millions that would be in one DNA strand. So this is not nearly a big enough DNA. It just shows you four because to remind you that there are four different kinds of nitrogenous bases that DNA uses. But anyway, there's four nucleotides here, four monomers, one of them which is labeled here. Even though this is a single subunit, a nucleotide, of the polymer, it still contains three parts itself. And this should be reviewed at this point. We've talked about this several times. And to be a nucleotide, you have to have all three of these components. You have to have a pentose, or five-carbon sugar. And if it's DNA rather than RNA that you're building, that sugar has to be deoxyribose, specifically. Connected to that, you need to have two things. On one side of the sugar, you have to have a phosphate group. And all phosphates are basically the same, just like all deoxyriboses are the same as each other. Connected to the other side of the sugar is the third required component, which is some sort of nitrogenous base, nitrogen-containing base. And for DNA, there's four normal candidates, four choices. It can be either guanine, adenine, cytosine, or thymine. Those are the four nitrogenous bases. Okay, but nitrogenous base, pentose sugar, and phosphate together make up one nucleotide. If you then take a bunch of nucleotides and hook them together, you make a polymer or nucleic acid called a polynucleotide. That's one strand of DNA. But in the complete one DNA, as we use the word, the phrase, there's another strand as well, which is a molecule in its own right, and those two are held together. Okay. Notice the blue background here. This blueness represents what's called the sugar phosphate backbone of a polynucleotide, in this case DNA. It's called that because the way in which nucleotides are hooked together to make the polymer is by covalently bonding a phosphate from one nucleotide to the sugar of the next nucleotide, and then that next nucleotide's phosphate will be hooked to the next nucleotide's sugar, and so on. So it's sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, all the way down the length for millions of nucleotides. That's why it's called the sugar phosphate backbone, because that's the only thing that holds this thing together as a strand. Notice from the picture that none of these nitrogenous bases are involved at all in holding this thing together as a polymer. Now, this is really analogous to the situation in a polypeptide. So think back to how a polypeptide is built. It's a polymer made out of amino acids, right? The only reason we have different versions of amino acids is because that R group is different, right? But when you hook together two amino acids, you're hooking together the carboxyl of one amino acid to the amino of the other one. The R groups are just hanging off of that backbone. They're not involved in keeping it together at all. Similarly, these nitrogenous bases are not at all involved in holding this together as a strand. Holding it together as a strand is a big deal in DNA. That's because DNA is an informational molecule. It carries information. The information is the specific sequence of of nitrogenous bases. Right? If you only had one kind of nitrogenous base, it wouldn't carry much information, right? It would be like everyone's phone number being 222-2222. People have different phone numbers because there's all kinds of different sequences of numerals. Similarly, there's all kinds of sequences of nitrogenous bases in DNA. That is the information that it carries. But it's only that information is kept intact only if you hold the thing together in that sequence. So the sugar phosphate backbone has to be strong so this thing doesn't fall apart and you lose all the information. You lose the sequence. That's why the sugar phosphate backbone is made up of covalent bonds. They are strong. And under normal living conditions, a strand will remain as a strand. All right? Let's go on to 5 and talk about Rosalind Franklin. Unfortunately, because of sexism during her life, she wasn't given much credit. She's credited a lot nowadays, though, in her contribution to figuring out what the shape of DNA is. Now, the people that actually got, the men that actually got awarded the Nobel Prize for that were Watson and Crick, which you've probably heard of. They did important work as well. They deserved the prize, but she deserved to be mentioned because she really helped them out. She was a worldwide expert in a technique called X-ray crystallography. So Watson and Crick were busy, they were realizing what the individual chemicals were that made up DNA. They just couldn't figure out how the molecule was built, how it was shaped. And X-ray crystallography, which was Rosalind Franklin's expertise, is a way to figure out the shape of particles indirectly. What you do is bombard the particle with X-rays, which are light, remember, but invisible to us, light, higher energy beyond the blue end. They're photons, in other words. And so you spray this molecule, whatever it is, with photons, and the photons get scattered in a certain way by that molecule, and then they hit X-ray film, just like visible light hits normal photographic film to make a picture. You see a picture on the right side. This is a famous image. It doesn't look like much to us, but to her as an expert in crystallography, she told Watson and Crick, who were trying to figure out the shape, that this pattern hinted at it being helical in shape. And so that's when they trusted her expertise and they said, let's start building a helix and see how it can work. And that's when they made their famous tin model that you've probably seen in other pictures. Well, slide 6 shows you a cartoon version of the model that they built, a double helix. Remember, that's one DNA, but it's really two different polynucleotides, each one with its own blue sugar phosphate backbone. But when they're together, it's a double helix because each individual strand is a helical shape or a corkscrew shape, which, once assembled, looks very much like a spiral staircase or a twisted ladder is a good analogy. Because if you mentally untwist this ladder into a normal ladder, just a straight ladder, you have what's shown in the middle in cartoon form, right? The two vertical parts of the ladder are the two sugar phosphate backbones of the two strands. And then making the rungs of the ladder, or the steps, are pairs of nitrogenous bases. Each rung, though, is made up of a pair of nitrogenous bases, one of which is connected to one strand and the other of which is connected to the other strand but in the same position. In other words, each rung of the ladder, the width of that rung of the ladder, is half a nitrogenous base from one strand and half a nitrogenous base from the other strand. Okay, now another thing that we see from this middle part is that each of the two strands in a DNA has polarity to it, which has nothing to do with electrical charge. It just means there's two ends that are different. And so each strand has a so-called 5' end and a 3' end. Now, those are named for what is connected to the sugar and where. So at the 5' end, you have a phosphate group, But it's called the 5' end because that phosphate group is connected to the fifth of the five carbons. So this is carbon 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the fifth one is hanging off the ring. Okay, so the phosphate is connected to the fifth carbon. That's why it's the 5' end. On the other end of that same strand, you have the 3' end, which is a hydroxyl, connected directly to that third carbon, so the 3' end. Well, not only is each strand polarized, each strand has a 3' and a 5' end, but the overall DNA is described as being antiparallel. What that means is that when the two strands get together, they're matched up in such a way that the 5' end of one strand is next to the 3' end of the other, and vice versa. So kind of a head-to-tail arrangement. Now, what makes this a ladder, of course, is that the two half rungs are connected to each other to make an overall rung of the ladder. And that's where these pink dots come into play. Notice that those are hydrogen bonds. Hydrogen bonds, recall, are not chemical bonds. They're much weaker than covalent bonds, but they don't form a new molecule, right? They just hold two molecules together, but they're still separate molecules. Just like two water molecules, hydrogen bonded together, are still two separate water molecules. That's why I say that each strand, each polynucleotide in the overall DNA is still a separate molecule, but they're held together by hydrogen bonds. And the hydrogen bonds occur between nitrogenous bases from each of the two strands. Now, just as it's important for the sugar phosphate backbone to be strong and therefore use covalent bonds, it's also important for the bonds between the nitrogenous bases to be weak, which is why they're hydrogen bonds. You need the strength of the sugar phosphate backbone, like I said, so that you don't scramble the information and lose it. But you need the two strands to be weakly held together because both of the two functions of DNA require the two strands to be separated. So who wants to remind us of what those two functions of DNA are? Transcription is one. No, DNA is not involved in translation. Replication, yes. Both replication and transcription require getting in there and reading the sequence of nucleotides, the sequence of nitrogenous bases. Getting in there and reading those requires separating the two strands from each other temporarily. So both replication and transcription need the DNA strands to be separated from each other, which is why it's important that those bonds are not covalent. Those bonds are weak hydrogen bonds. Now, each individual hydrogen bond is weak, of course, and therefore easy to break. But, as I said, these strands are millions of nucleotides long, so you have millions of hydrogen bonds, each individually weak, adding up to enough force to keep these things together normally. They're only separated when the cell intentionally goes in there and separates them. Another important thing about DNA, really important about how it works, is that it has complementarity. Complementarity refers to the fact that the sequence in one strand is kind of like the inverse of the sequence in the other strand. Specifically, what that means is that wherever you have an adenine on one strand, in that same position on the other strand, you have to have a thymine. A always pairs up with T to make these rungs. T always pairs up with A. C always pairs up with G. G always pairs up with C. That is complementarity. So one strand is complementary to the other strand within the same DNA. Now, when Watson and Crick built their model, that's when they realized that there was complementarity. And in that first groundbreaking article in Science that they published, it was just about the shape, but they just offhandedly said in the final paragraph, they mentioned this complementarity, and that they realized that that was going to be an important thing, because it's complementarity that actually allows DNA to have the important quality of being able to replicate itself, to form perfect copies of itself. And that's because if you have to always have T with A and always have C with G, then whatever one strand sequence is determines what the other strand sequence has to be, right? And therefore, each strand by itself can serve as a template for how to build the other strand, which is how DNA replication works, as we'll see. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about complementarity. This is slide 7. Complementarity, as I said, is C always with G, A always with T. Part of that is explained by what we're looking at in slide 7. Now, there are four overall DNA nitrogenous bases: adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine. But although there are four overall, they're grouped into two categories of nitrogenous bases. Two of them are purines and two of them are pyrimidines. As you can see here, the purines have two rings in their structure. The pyrimidines have one ring in their structure. When I was first learning this, I could never remember which two were purines and which two were pyrimidines. But then one day I noticed something that helped me, and hopefully it'll help you. The two pyrimidines are thymine and cytosine. And both of those names, cytosine and thymine, have Y in it, just like the word pyrimidine does. Whereas the other two, adenine and guanine, do not have a Y. Those are the purines, which also doesn't have a Y in its name. So part of this complementarity results from the fact that this ladder, which is twisted normally, but we're looking at it untwisted here, has to have rungs of the ladder that are all the same width, just like in a normal ladder, right? Well, if you paired together two purines, that would make a rung of the ladder that's wider. If you paired together two pyrimidines, it would be narrower. But if you always pair together one purine and one pyrimidine, then it doesn't matter which of those two is on the right or the left. They're going to add up to the correct width. And therefore, the ladder will be nice and straight and a normal ladder, but twisted. So this explains only part of complementarity, though, because remember, there are two types of purines and two types of pyrimidines. You would get the right width of rungs if you used either of the two purines with either of the two pyrimidines, but that's not what happens in DNA. It's more strict than that. It's not only purine with pyrimidine always. It's specifically adenine with thymine always and guanine with cytosine. So it's not just the width that matters. The rest of the explanation is shown in slide 8. Here are the two pairings that we see in DNA: adenine with thymine, or thymine with adenine, either could be on the right or left, and guanine with cytosine, or cytosine with guanine. Now, what's different about these two pairings that you notice? That's right. The difference is the number of hydrogen bonds that are being formed. Adenine and thymine each can make two hydrogen bonds because of the atoms involved. And so they are a perfect fit with each other. Guanine and cytosine can each make three hydrogen bonds, and therefore they go together perfectly. So not only is the combination of these the right width, because one's a purine and one's a pyrimidine, but they also match up perfectly with their hydrogen bonds if it's specifically G with C and specifically A with T. And those two facts together make for strict complementarity. All right, let's go to 9 and talk about the usefulness of this complementarity. I said this a little bit ago, but if you have a double-stranded DNA and you separate the two strands and you hide one from me, but you tell me what the sequence is in the other one, I can tell you exactly what the sequence is in the one that you hid from me, right? Simply using the rules of complementarity. Well, similarly, if you separate the two strands in a cell, and the cell can read each strand, it can tell by that code what the other strand that you're trying to copy needs to be. So each strand, in other words, serves as a template for how to build a copy of the other strand. And when both of those things happen, both strands are used as a template, then you form two copies of the original double-stranded DNA. They're identical to each other, and they're both identical to the original DNA. That's important because the two daughter cells that a cell splits into need to have exactly the same DNA that the original cell had. Not just DNA, it has to be the DNA, because that sequence is what gives it its function. So the chapter of the book that this was used from uses, not only in this slide, but in several subsequent slides, the same color scheme. The darker blue represents original DNA before the replication, in other words. And then the lighter blue represents newer DNA that's laid down in the replication process. What you see is separation. You have complementarity. Separation, each strand is used for a template to build a copy of the other strand, and you end up with two copies, each of which has one original strand and one new strand. Okay? Half old and half new material. Okay, so to test how this happens, they needed to consider the three possibilities. If you assume that complementarity rules govern DNA replication, then there really are only three possibilities. These are exhaustive possibilities, these three. It has to be either the conservative model, semi-conservative model, or dispersive model. Now, the fully conservative model, or just the conservative model as it's called, fully conserves the original DNA. You start with a double-stranded DNA, and it is conserved through the generations as DNA replication happens over and over. But it's used as a code for how to build a completely new double-stranded DNA. That's why you have the original two strands still together here and two brand new strands together in the other copy. Semi-conservative model says that the two strands get separated. One strand, one original strand is put into one copy along with one brand new strand, and the same thing for the other copy. Well, the only other possibility mathematically is the so-called dispersive model, which is also by far the least likely to happen because it's most complex. And most often in nature, the things that are the least complex are the things that actually occur. But still, this is a mathematical possibility, so it had to be tested. In any case, the dispersive model cuts the DNA apart into small chunks, each of which, each little chunk of which, serves as a template for how to build a complementary chunk, and then they're all hooked together. So the copies are, neither strand is original. It's each of the two strands is partly old and partly new material. Okay, partly blue, dark blue and light blue. Okay, well, let's look at the experiment that was designed to test which of these three models is the truth. What they did was use labeling again. I shouldn't say again because it's a different group of scientists, but this is not radio labeling. This is using isotopes once again, but instead of being radioactive, they use just a normal version of nitrogen and a heavy version of nitrogen. N15 is still nitrogen, it just has an extra neutron, and therefore, in a centrifugation scheme, it's going to be a little heavier than normal nitrogen. Right? So they use this heavy nitrogen for in a solution that allowed for several replications of DNA until effectively all of the DNA contained heavy nitrogen. That's what they then use as the original DNA, the dark blue stuff. Then they switch to an environment that contained no heavy nitrogen, only regular nitrogen. And all of the new DNA after that point was therefore the lighter version stuff, okay, the light blue. That's how they kept them separate. And then they centrifuged them to see what happened. Well, each of the three models has different predictions about what would happen after centrifugation. The fully conservative model predicts there to be two different levels in the tube, right? The heavy stuff, fully original DNA should go to the bottom. The fully new DNA should go to the top. They didn't see that. That's the big red X. So just right away, they proved that the conservative model can't be true. But the problem is that just doing it once for one replication generation doesn't tell you which of the other two is correct, because both of these other have the same prediction. You should see one level in the centrifuge tube because each DNA is half old and half new material, just in different ways. Right? So they shouldn't be heavy or light, they should be medium. And they saw that, but that doesn't tell you which of these is true. So they had to do it another round. And that's where the predictions differ between the two models. The dispersive model predicts still just one level, only it's getting higher in the tube because it's getting more and more new material, and therefore lighter. Well, that didn't happen. The semi-conservative model on the second generation predicts two different levels in the centrifuge tube, which is exactly what they saw. So, well-designed, elegant experiment that clearly demonstrates that the semi-conservative model is actually what happens in cells. It also makes sense based on what I just showed you and told you about in the previous slides. Each strand remains intact, right? They just get separated from each other. Each strand serves as a template for how to build a copy of the other strand, and therefore each daughter DNA is one old strand and one new strand. That brings us to 12, which I think maybe I won't start. That's probably a good place to pause for the day. I'll see you in lab.